Today is Wednesday, October the 20th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Last week, Facebook was in the hot seat with Congress. This week, it's Amazon in the hot seat with Congress. U.S. lawmakers say Amazon misled Congress. The House Judiciary Antitrust Subcommittee is giving Amazon one last chance to tell the whole truth about its use of third-party sellers' data. On Monday, five House Judiciary Committee members published a letter accusing executives, including Amazon founder and chairman Jeff Bezos, of possibly lying to Congress during an antitrust investigation, adding that they're considering referring this to the Department of Justice for a criminal investigation. The letter refers to last week's Reuters report showing that the company had an explicit, detailed strategy to rip off third-party sellers in India, use their data to streamline their own knockoffs, and prioritize its products in search results. Last year, in a House Antitrust Subcommittee hearing, Bezos didn't deny those practices, but passed the buck to hypothetical bad actors within Amazon. What I can tell you is we have a policy against using seller-specific data to aid our private label business. And he said, I can't guarantee that that policy has never been violated. Amazon's been sticking to that line that the company has a policy, and it's possible that bad employees violate this policy. It's extremely unclear what would motivate an employee to violate company policy in order to help the company. At best, this reporting confirms that Amazon representatives misled the committee. The letter states, at worst, it demonstrates that they may have lied to Congress in possible violation of federal criminal law. Committee members also point to similar reports from The Markup, The Wall Street Journal, and the Capital Forum, stating that the reports are inconsistent with the sworn testimony and numerous statements made by Amazon executives to the committee during our investigation into Amazon's business practices last Congress. Amazon has denied findings in each report that Amazon uses non-public, seller-specific data and unfairly boosts its own brands. An Amazon spokesperson said outright that Amazon and its executive did not mislead the committee, and we have denied and sought to correct the record on the inaccurate media article in question. They added that Amazon's internal policy prohibits the use of individual sellers' data to develop Amazon private label products, and that Amazon investigates potential violations. Last year, two U.S. lawmakers accused Amazon of lying to Congress, after a Wall Street Journal report found that documents and employee interviews confirmed that the company tapped third-party sellers' data, which is considered private, for its own gain. The Journal noted that Amazon could use that data to identify the most desirable product features or set its price points. That contradicted a 2019 testimony from Amazon's Associate General Counsel, who said that we do not use any seller data for to compete with them. Amazon General Counsel sent a letter doubling down, writing that Amazon prohibits, in our private label strategy, the use of data related specifically to individual sellers and aggregated store data on total sales and search volume for categories and products. A new deceptive and injection campaign has been found leveraging an ad blocker extension for Google Chrome and Opera web browsers to sneakily insert ads and affiliate codes on websites, according to new research from cybersecurity firm Imperva. The findings come following the discovery of rogue domains distributing an ad injection script in late August of this year that the researchers connected to an add-on called AllBlock, A-L-L-B-L-O-C-K. The extension has since been pulled from both the Chrome Web Store and Opera add-ons marketplaces. While AllBlock is designed to block ads legitimately, the JavaScript code is injected into every new tab open on the browser. It works by identifying and sending all links in a web page, typically on search engine results pages, to a remote server, which responds back with a list of websites to replace the genuine links with, leading to a scenario where, upon clicking a link, the victim is redirected to a different page. When the user clicks on any modified links on the web page, he or she will be redirected to an affiliate link. Imperva researchers said via this affiliate fraud, the attacker earns money when specific actions like registration or sale of the product takes place. AllBlock is also characterized by a variety of techniques aimed at avoiding detection, including clearing the debug console every 100 milliseconds and excluding major search engines. Imperva said the AllBlock extension is likely part of a larger distribution campaign that may have utilized other browser extensions and delivery methods, with ties observed to a PBOT campaign based on overlaps in domain names and IP addresses. Ad injection is an evolving threat that can impact almost any site. Attackers will use anything from browser extensions to malware and adware installed on visitors' devices, still making site owners ill-equipped to handle such attacks. When ad injection is used, the site performance and user experience is degraded, making websites slower and harder to use. Other impacts of ad injections include loss of customer trust and loyalty, revenue loss from ad placements, block content, and diminished conversion rates. The Great Resignation and the IT professionals. A lasting effect of this pandemic will be a revolution in worker expectations. In April, the number of workers who quit their job in a single month broke an all-time U.S. record. Economists call it the Great Resignation. But America's quitting spirit was just getting started. In July, even more people left their jobs, and in August, quitters set yet another record. Quits, as the Bureau of Labor Statistics call them, are rising in almost every industry. Thanks to several pandemic relief checks, a rent moratorium, and student loan forgiveness, many, particularly if they are young and have a low income, have more freedom to quit jobs they hate and hop to something else. Quitting is also a concept typically in the past associated with losers and loafers. But this level of quitting is really an expression of optimism that says we can do better. Many have clung to crappy jobs for fear that the safety net wouldn't support them while they look for a new one. But Americans seem to have done with sticking it out. Job openings are today plentiful. Many positions are going unfilled for months. Meanwhile, the basic terms of employment are undergoing a great reset. The pandemic thrust many families into a homebound lifestyle reminiscent of the 19th century agrarian economy. But this time, with the screens galore and online delivery, more families today work at home, cook at home, care for kids at home, entertain themselves at home, and some even school their kids at home. This is the rise of the do-it-yourself family, and it represents a new vision of work and life balance that is still coming to focus. By eliminating the office as a physical presence in many, but not all, families, the pandemic may have downgraded work as a centerpiece of their identity. For many, remote work will collapse the boundary between work and life that was once delineated by the daily commute, but this is a time of broad reconsideration. Finally, there is a great reshuffling of people and businesses around the country. Several major companies such as Twitter have announced permanent work-from-home policies, while others such as Tesla have moved their headquarters. A major salutary long-term effect of the pandemic may have been about urban redesign and office occupancy, but we may instead look back to the pandemic as a crucial inflection point. The Great Resignation is speeding up, and it's created a seminal moment in American economic history. The Great Resignation is one of the movements in the global workforce that is now hitting the industry hard, with more people joining suit every day. Unlike tourism, automobile, or many others who took a major hit in 2020, the tech industry thrived thanks to the internet, with almost everyone in the world staying indoors for months and everything went online, including education, shopping, banking, and all these meant more work for the IT industry. Software engineers around the world worked tirelessly to provide all these online while creating new services and improving existing ones. And network engineers had a hard time preparing the infrastructure to accommodate everything going online. But the majority of the work was done remotely, which initially was a blessing for many. But later we realized the negative impacts of bringing work home as well. Of course, doctors and farmers were the biggest heroes during the pandemic. They protected our lives and put food on our plates when we were sitting in the comfort of our homes, and nothing can be compared to that. But the comfort that everyone talks about wouldn't have been possible without the IT professionals who work day and night to make sure that people's lives are least disrupted even when they are sitting at home. Students and teachers could still attend classes from the safety of their homes, thanks to online facilities like Google Classrooms. Families could stay connected with loved ones, at least over video calls, thanks to FaceTime, Duo, and Zoom, and many others who stepped up and made the services free. People were entertained with platforms like Netflix, Prime, and even simple multiplayer games, which gave people a chance to have fun with people outside the four walls that they were confined to. Many people may not think these are important now, but these simple luxuries were an integral part of our daily lives and helped us stay indoors and, most importantly, stay sane. And needless to say, programs who wrote billions of lines of code kept systems running 24/7. Remote work was one of the prominent changes that happened during the pandemic, but it has always been there. It's just that most companies were holding the cards when it came to when an employee could take it. But there are some other important facts that may have led programmers to join the movement, and let's take a look at some. Flexibility was always something that most programmers wanted, and many companies hesitated to provide it even when they could. But this was a very crucial factor when the pandemic hit back in 2020. Companies that had work-from-home options benefited from their wise decision to provide flexibility. Work-at-home workers had a smooth transition to completely remote work. Companies skeptical about the whole concept had a more difficult time adopting the changes, and many big corporations had to literally force at least half of the employees to the office at least for a few months while everyone was working from home. Imagine having to go to work in a big office when the roads and food courts are empty and many of your friends working in other companies are comfortably sitting and working from their homes. This was the first trigger for many people. They started realizing that working for a huge company is not enough. At the end of the day, if your company is forcing you to come to the office for a job that can be completed from literally anywhere in the world, then it's time to reassess your choices. To be precise, the IT professionals started looking at more viable options. For some companies, there is a requisite to have the ability to work under pressure as a requirement for many technical roles. If you think about it, every job has a certain level of stress associated with it for 90% of the people. But to describe the ability to work under pressure as on a consistent basis and pass it off as a highly positive trait is exactly what's been wrong with our system for so long. If a company has an environment that requires its employees to work under pressure constantly, there is something seriously wrong with the way they operate, and people are finally realizing it. Programming is not something to be done under stress. Working under stress leads to compromised quality, or simply put, more bugs than what a normal project should have. And it also leads to sleeplessness, fatigue, and other health issues when done over a prolonged period of time. people are searching for answers to why physically active and healthy people are losing their lives to a heart attack. But what they don't realize, and many doctors stress upon, is that stress is one of the most important reasons behind early heart attacks. All these make a healthy work environment a very important and decisive factor for IT professionals who are finally realizing that there are many companies out there who put their people first, or at least in a better position than their current employer. More and more tech workers are choosing healthy working conditions over high compensation or fancy titles at a huge company. It's 2021, and technology is all about rapid change. And if there's something that's guaranteed not to change over the coming decade in technology, it's change itself. Every field requires people to upskill once in a while to keep up with this industry, but there's no other industry like the tech industry that is so unpredictable and vulnerable to change. In the tech field, one is required to watch out for new languages, frameworks, and operating systems. An interesting fact is that there are some tech companies who don't give much importance to this constant upskilling or keeping up with the latest industry tech trends. Companies may have many reasons to do it, but the most prominent one is always cost. The cost of migrating to new technology, cost of training employees in a new tech, or cost of time spent for this training, which could otherwise be used to churn in more money-making projects. But what these companies don't realize is that they're headed for extinction, just like Blockbuster and Kodak, who were victims of not adapting to rapidly changing technologies. Tech workers are now looking at the bigger picture, or more precisely, starting to care about their own future. Gone are the days when you needed a college degree to become a software engineer. Anyone with a laptop and internet connection can learn even the most advanced concepts without spending a fortune on student loans. If a company is not giving enough opportunities to learn a new tech or switch to a more relevant one, programmers will now easily choose somewhere they have a better opportunity to learn. It may seem like an inevitable cause for resignation for almost everyone in every industry, but there may be a particular reason why people are more concerned about compensation more than ever. Even though it was a free world before the pandemic, companies were always taking advantage of programmers and underpaying them. This was more of an issue in developing regions like Asia, where many programmers were underpaid, while their employer made dollars to cents for the same work from the clients. The change to this dynamic was already happening before the pandemic, as more companies started opening up offices directly in those developing countries, instead of outsourcing their work to cheap contract companies. But the pandemic and completely remote work boosted the competition even more. Companies started caring even less about hiring people from the same region as their physical offices, and rather started hiring highly skilled talents from around the world and offering them better compensation than local markets. One more important factor that contributed to the compensation race is the rise in the number of successful startups. Corporations are not the only ones with money now, and they are no longer holding the cards. Startups are getting tons of money from investors to penetrate upcoming business categories, which give higher return on investment. This gives the smaller companies enough financial leverage to lure in talent by offering a high compensation along with good work culture, perks that matter like parental leaves and mandatory vacations. And programmers now know that they have a choice rather than having to settle for the occasional free pizza or team lunches. The movement is real and mostly here to stay. When the pandemic hit us in April of last year, the national unemployment rate in the United States soared to a record-breaking 14.8%. Fast forward and another year, and companies are struggling to keep their workforce together, with more people wanting to leave their jobs for better workplaces or a career shift. Some popular surveys by major corporations say this is the result of people being too lazy during the pandemic and not wanting to come back to the office. What companies need to understand is that this is not a random movement that went viral. According to a report by Inc.com, 11.5 million workers quit their jobs in April, May, and June of this year. The report also says that half of the workforce with a full-time job is actively looking for a change. All these surveys point to only one thing, and that is the prediction that these numbers are going to rise to much higher figures by the end of the year. Just like every other case, there are exceptions where huge companies transform themselves. We know today that there is a shortage of semiconductors, but there is a much larger question, and that is China controlling the global semiconductor industry, or at least trying to? The United States Innovation and Competition Act, that's a USICA of 2021, which passed the Senate in June, calls for $52 billion in appropriations over 5 years to support semiconductor manufacturing as well as research and development. Investing tens of billions of dollars would be a waste if that investment is not part of a larger strategy to prevent China from stealing or buying its way to domination of advanced semiconductor manufacturing. If Beijing succeeds in this domain, it will likely try to force Western firms out of the market for advanced semiconductors while enabling Chinese intelligence to compromise key technology supply chains. Semiconductors are the insulated materials that make possible the fabrication of the nanoscale microchips that inhabit all modern electronics. The most advanced manufacturing equipment uses increasingly small yet more powerful chips to store and process information. Microchips also enable computation-heavy tasks such as on-device artificial intelligence, calculating missile trajectories for advanced weapon systems, and processing financial transactions for global trade. Recognizing that leadership in semiconductors confers not only economic, but also strategic advantages, China seeks to transform its economy so it can displace the United States and its allies as the market leaders in semiconductors and other critical technologies. To that end, since 2000, China has increasingly subsidized its semiconductor manufacturing sector with a reported $15 billion per year, growing its stake in the global market to over 20% in 2020. While this investment is significant, the technology undergirding China's domestic production capability still remains 5 to 10 years behind that of its democratic competitors, specifically in terms of the size of the microchips produced. The most advanced semiconductors are manufactured in the United States, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Netherlands. Three companies, America's Intel Corporation, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, and South Korea's Samsung Group, manufacture the finished products. But firms in the other countries on that list have significant stakes in supply chain or manufacturing processes. China aims to reduce its dependence on imported chips by developing a robust domestic manufacturing capability. Right now, China lacks chip manufacturing facilities capable of fabricating the kind of advanced semiconductors necessary for the demanding computational tasks of next-generation technologies. Beijing must obtain the necessary equipment from the West if China wants to accelerate its semiconductor industry to the next level. If China were to establish a microchip production capability on par with that of the Western companies, one could expect Beijing to pursue unfair business practices as it did in the telecommunication business after Huawei established technological parity with the foreign competitors. Such practices include controlling exports of raw materials, undercutting market prices, and otherwise undermining Western counterparts and driving them from the field. If this happened in the semiconductor industry, it would leave a vital supply chain open to compromise by Chinese intelligence officials, resulting in vulnerabilities that would have disastrous cascading impacts for U.S. national security and the U.S. economy. Additionally, given the role that advanced semiconductor manufacturing has played in building China's AI-enabled domestic surveillance system, greater Chinese control of the semiconductor market will only accelerate Beijing's development of technology that it can use to facilitate human rights abuses. In 2010, the world witnessed the danger of supply chain dependence on China. Beijing blocked rare earth elements exported to Japan to pressure Tokyo to back down from a territorial dispute with China in the East China Sea. Japan suffered the economic damage, but then partnered with an Australian producer to develop a non-China-based supply chain. The United States and its allies cannot afford to allow China to dominate and manipulate the global semiconductor market in a similar manner. Today, Beijing needs advanced semiconductor manufacturing equipment such as extreme ultraviolet, that's EUV, lithography, and argon fluoride immersion photolithography, access to advanced materials such as photomask and photoresist, manufacturing software such as electronic design automation software, and licenses related to the intellectual property of chips designed by competing manufacturers. If unable to purchase this state-of-the-art manufacturing equipment, China would likely need over a decade to produce that equipment on its own, by which time the United States and its allies will likely have moved on to even more advanced production capabilities. Rather than develop its own products, China appears determined to buy its way to parity with Western manufacturers by making deals with Western companies. In 2019, Advanced Semiconductor Material Lithography, a Dutch technology company specializing in EUV lithography tools, announced that it had reached a deal to sell equipment to the Chinese firm Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, otherwise with the acronym SMIC. However, Washington intervened and was able to pressure the Dutch government to shut down the deal. Relying on an ad hoc approach to identifying and disrupting impending deals that might transfer sensitive technology to China could easily fail. Instead, the United States and relevant allies and partners should forge a robust formal agreement to identify the key technology they need to protect and to restrict China's efforts to import the equipment required for advanced semiconductor manufacturing. The Dutch company's actions to block AMSL sale of EUV tools was an important first step. Tokyo provided critical help by assuring Washington that Japanese firms would not attempt to sell EUV tools to SMIC if the Dutch blocked the sale by ASML. There is precedent for formalizing such cooperation through an official trade agreement, which the United States achieved in the field of non-proliferation via the Proliferation Security Initiative. Additionally, the United States should increase funding for domestic production of semiconductors as originally authorized by the Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors, otherwise known as CHIPS for America Act, which Congress passed as part of the fiscal year 2021 National Defense Authorization Act, and which is now being funded in USICA and in the current administration's infrastructure bill. Domestic manufacturing, whether by U.S. firms or partner firms operating in the United States, is an important component of building trusted global supply chains. The other component is establishing agreements with allies and partners to boost their domestic production as well. Washington's efforts to secure the rare earth supply chain through agreements with Japan, Australia, and Canada could serve as a useful model. The recent agreement by Taiwan Semiconductor, the Taiwanese chip manufacturer, to build a foundry in Arizona is another good example. Collectively, coordinated export restrictions and greater domestic and allied production not only would counter China's strategy to influence companies and dominate key industries, but would also help address ongoing market shortages of semiconductors and graphic cards. Beijing's efforts to dominate the global semiconductor industry through the acquisition of advanced manufacturing equipment pose a threat to U.S. economic prosperity and national security. If China can penetrate and dominate the sensitive semiconductor ecosystem, Beijing can hold parts of the semiconductor supply chain hostage to advance other strategic objectives that damage Western interests. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. One of three most difficult tasks admitting a mistake.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. Except, whoa, wait a second. I'm going to talk about the three most difficult tasks for many IT professionals, and I'm actually going to spread this out over the course of 3 weeks. The first one, and this actually applies to everybody. Let me back up. This applies to you. Whether or not you're an IT professional, whether or not you're in IT, whether or not you're in the workplace, all three of these are items that we all deal with on a regular basis. Whether we're dealing with our spouses, whether we're dealing with our finances, our just day-to-day life, whatever it is. And I'm going to approach these in a particular order. So hang with me for the next 3 weeks. So this week, admitting to and owning your mistakes. Okay. So I'm going to be honest with you. I do take special efforts in advance. I will go through and I will make a backup plan, a backout plan. I will make my contingencies very clear. I note these down. Long-term planning is key, but it's actually also missing in the fast-paced world of IT, in the fast-paced world of business, in the fast-paced world of everything. We've stopped doing long-term planning, but that's not part of admitting and owning your mistakes because they're still going to happen. And this leads me into really a lot of what I want to talk about. And that is, first and foremost, I know that I'm not perfect. We need to know that we're not perfect. Robert Anson Heinlein, he used a term in a book called Stranger in a Strange Land. This term, this word, it was big in the culture of the 70s. It was grok, G-R-O-K. And when it is to know, but it is to know to a mastery extent, and we need to grok that we are not perfect. We need to know to that level of mastery that we are not perfect. We also need to embrace that in our life. That's part of that grok. We need to know it and we need to embrace it. We need to know that life is not all about us. Whether it's our mistakes or our successes, and we need to know that there are ways out. And all of this goes back to, we need to grok or know that we are not perfect. See, all of that matches in with all of the rest of it. We need to understand this to a deeper level than we've ever understood it before, as individuals and as people around the world. It's just part of life. And I will mix in just a little bit of religion here. I don't do this all the time, but look, we remember that there's basically been one perfect guy. It was 2,000 years ago, and there's reasons why he had to be perfect. It was to allow us some flexibility in our imperfections, and there's a lot to that. If you really want to go down that road, check in with your local clergy and discuss all of that, the sacrifice and things like that. Not requiring you to. But you need to embrace this imperfection. And as part of this, we need to admit when we made a mistake. We need to own up to it. And whether we're talking about as an IT professional, oops, I made a mistake with the server and I crashed the server. It'll take me a little while. I need to be nimble and adaptive and I need to shift what my plans were for the day. I'll back out. I'll take care of whatever I have to do with the server and bring it back online. We have to do this in our regular day-to-day business aspects. I made a mistake on this particular report or this particular letter, and I need to go and I need to fix this. I need to move forward. I need to be there for this, and I need to take care of it rather than trying to sweep it under the rug, rather than saying, oh, Joey did it over there. He's the one who's responsible for this. No, own up to it. People will respect you if you own up to your mistakes. People, especially if you're ready to fix them. Oh, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. Let's take care of this. Do you want help with this? Or do you trust me? I can fix this. I know what I'm doing. I will take care of this. There's that great communication. We can use this in our lives too. I have made mistakes with my wife and with my son, and I have asked for forgiveness from them. I've admitted it. I've owned up to it. And this is something we all need to do. It's a difficult task for IT pros. It's a difficult task for everybody. IT pros even more, because we have a certain level at times as an industry of thinking we know a lot more about computers than everybody else, and therefore we know a lot more about everything than everybody else. And that's really not true. But that's another discussion for, another series that's probably about 100 long. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. You have a computer system that you want to get rid of by giving it away or maybe just throwing it into the trash. But before you want to do it, you want to make sure that the information on the drive is not there because you may have personal information on it. Well, destroying information on a disk drive, well, it can't be easy, and it is not all that complex if you can understand what to do. Computer experts say it takes time and effort to make electronics unreadable. It all depends on who you are protecting the data from. For most consumers, a reinstallation of the operating system will do the trick. Let's say you have a personal computer and you just want to give it away or dispose of the unit because you have recently purchased another system with the latest operating system. If it is a Windows system, the simplest method is to do a factory reset with the hidden partition information you have on the hard disk drive to reinstall the operating system. If the system is running Mac OS, you can restore your Mac to factory resetting by erasing your Mac, then using Mac OS recovery, the built-in recovery system on your Mac to reinstall Mac OS. But if you're trying to keep secrets from the FBI or NSA, forget about it. The forensic techniques available today are remarkably advanced, from recovering ghost images to reading minuscule fragments of disk platters. Any given file occupies less than 0.0015 square inch, so that even small fragments can be read with advanced equipment. Chemical destruction would get the job done, but it is not very practical. Thermite will do the trick nicely for the average consumer. However, this is definitely not recommended. Thermite is a pyrotechnic composition of metal powder and metal oxide. When ignited by heat or chemical reaction, thermite undergoes an exothermic reduction oxidation reaction. Most varieties are not explosive, but can create brief bursts of heat and high temperature in a small area. Computer security experts are acutely aware of how far it is necessary to go to truly obliterate data. Still, for anyone who really wants to protect their data, the first and most obvious, though often forgotten, line of defense is to encode it with the proper digital key. Getting the data back out is infeasible, and therefore physical destruction is a bit redundant. Just using a hammer to whack it, it won't do it. If someone just destroys the external electronic circuit board and the internal platters are okay, then it is not hard to restore the drive. It really depends on how much damage was done to the interior media. Experts say computer hard drives can be destroyed in two main ways: by overwriting the data on them or by physically destroying their platters. Those are disk coated with magnetic media where the ones and zeros that make up the digital information are stored. Most home computer users use wiping programs to clean data off hard drives. These writes and rewrites over the hard drive covering the data that's on it so many times it's unreadable. This process, however, takes hours. The best way to destroy the information on a hard drive is to take it apart and then run a degausser over the platters. A degausser is a high-intensity magnet that creates magnetic hysteria, scrambling the ones and zeros on the platter. High-quality commercial-strength degaussing wands start at a few hundred dollars and can cost more than $1,000. In the past, I've used these to wipe out hard disk drives. Caution, though, anyone with a pacemaker or an expensive watch, step away. It's a very strong magnet. Another popular method used by business is to simply shred the hard drive in a commercial powder shredder, which breaks it up into pieces that can be small as a matchstick. Those aren't cheap, generally costing a few thousand dollars. The typical home user wouldn't have one at their disposal. The methods home users often try don't work. Some people try to drill holes in the hard drives, but you can get a lot of data back from damaged platters because it is obviously not where the holes were, but everywhere else. Recovering data is done in several different ways. A poorly overwritten hard drive simply requires a computer program that goes in and retrieves the information. For a drive that's been physically damaged, digital forensic experts open it in a clean room, cleanse it, and then use a special reader to attempt to retrieve any data that's still there. It can take days of aligning everything to actually get it to work. The process isn't cheap. Simply finding deleted information can cost several thousand dollars, while rebuilding a damaged hard drive runs up to $10,000 or more. Generally, cell phones aren't worth the effort. Why? Because people forget that just about everything on their cell phone is also somewhere else, whether it's in the phone company records or backed up to the cloud. The records exist elsewhere. There is Direct Boot and Nuke, also known as DBAN, D-B-A-N, which is a piece of software. It is an entirely free data destruction program used to completely erase all the files on a hard drive, if you have the time. It is effective with hard disk drives, but it would take a long time to run, depending on the capacity of the drive. Do not use this program on a solid-state drive. Solid-state drives have limited write cycles, and using DBAN will dramatically reduce the number of write cycles available. Well, what about securely deleting all information on a solid-state drive? Solid-state drives are different from a hard disk drive. Solid-state drives are different from regular hard disk drives primarily because they use different technologies to record data. A hard disk drive is a spinning platter that writes with a moving mechanical arm. A solid-state drive is more akin to a flash memory stick, storing information in cells. To write new data to a cell, the drive must first erase the existing data. That's where the trim command comes in. During regular operations, solid-state drives essentially rapidly zero the data containing all cell before rewriting data. Solid-state drives maintain control over where data is written within the cells. This means that the operating system must request data to be written to block such and such, whereas a solid-state drive pointer table contains an altogether different number. This is known as where leveling. The data writes and retrieves, but there are differences. This process allows solid-state drives to manage data, always allocating an already zero block for the write process, while ensuring the flash memory degrades at an equal rate. Of course, there cannot be pre-zeroed blocks forever, and while the solid-state drive knows how to redirect its pointers to pre-zero blocks, it doesn't know about operating system marked unused blocks. This is where TRIM steps in. The TRIM command, that's T-R-I-M, allows the operating system to inform the solid-state drive as to which blocks are available for pre-zeroing, saving time and keeping the write process fast. Like a hard disk drive, a ready line of defense is encoded. Without the proper digital key, getting the data back out is infeasible, and therefore physical destruction is a bit redundant. If the hard disk drive or solid disk drive is part of the system that you're giving away, the factory reset is adequate for the average consumer. If the system is to be trashed, I recommend that you remove the drive. I have taken removed drives and placed them into an external enclosure and used them like an oversized USB flash drive. These enclosures are readily available from Micro Center and Newegg, costing $10 to $12. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Miscellaneous Products.
Marty Winston joins me again from his journeys around the country, around the world, and just some fantastic journeys. So what do you have for us this week?
Well, this week, as usual, it's a mélange, as they say.
Yeah, okay.
We recently mentioned 3D in terms of TV. Now,
sure.
Bosch, B-O-S-E-H, for anybody who's ever been in a Home Depot, it's the really cool lasers that can measure distance in three dimensions, calculate area and volume just by pushing buttons. And the new one we're dealing with right now is the Blaze Pro. And boy, is it accurate. And the range is terrific. I also, go ahead.
Yeah, my handyman has one of those. And, you know, it was one of those things. He was reluctant to buy one of those laser measures because, you know, the price point is, you know, it's $100. But he realized that it saved him so much time because you start unraveling that tape. You know, you start unraveling that tape, and then you gotta retract it. And every once in a while, you do that quick retraction, and it winds up going, and it snaps your finger, and it just pinches, and
oh no,
it
cut off his third arm.
So you know what? I think those are absolutely wonderful.
Also from Bosch.
Yeah. Oh wow.
This is a Bosch battery operated. Battery's not on the one I'm showing you.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, don't you wish you were on TV? This is a Bosch hammer drill driver.
Okay.
So it's got all three modes in it. As you can see, it's built to build tanks.
Yeah. Everything from Bosch it seems to be highly ruggedized.
Well, yes, that's because their roots are in the automotive industry.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you know, and you can probably hear.
Yeah, yeah.
That's you know, you set that ratchet when you don't want to turn it any harder than you have. So
yeah. So this is all three of them built into one device rather than you having a separate one for each of these.
Right. Okay. With the selector switch on top.
Yeah.
That lets you choose which one you're doing at the moment. Got a picture of a hammer, a picture of a screw, and a picture of a drill bit.
Okay. All right. Nice.
Levin Bosch. Bless your heels, and I hope you get more tools to send me. I'm not going to go to the other avalanche of tools just yet because I have some other devices that I want showed you. If you'll allow me a second, I'm moving some old grill parts to one side and picking up the Rockette Pyro keyboard.
I've been watching these guys since they first showed up at CES. I saw them in what eventually turned into Eureka Park, but they had a great mechanical keyboard then. And so tell me about this guy right here.
Well, a lot of this guy is about RGB colors.
Yeah.
It's about mechanical and the wonderful speed they're getting out of the keys.
Mm-hmm.
It is so fast, Ben, that your typing couldn't get ahead of it.
Very cool. So what are
it has a dedicated volume wheel on it, which I find very cool.
You know, I like the volume wheels rather than the volume buttons. I had a keyboard from one of the manufacturers, one of the big huge names that's located in Texas. They had a volume wheel on their keyboard like that, and that was great. I think everybody should be going in that direction. It is unfortunate that we've gone to this idea of press the button 28 times to lower it 28 decibels. You know, just.
I have a, not exactly a tool, but a lovely device from Canex, K-A-N-E-X, that gives you two display ports out of dual HDMI 4K support out of a, am I reading this right? Out of a single connector. So it's a quick multiplexer for display port to HDMI.
Very nice. So that's, it looks like DisplayPort to two HDMI, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is. DisplayPort to two HDMI.
And you know, that's really handy in the computer world because so many of these devices, they've got limited plugs on them.
Oh, indeed true. Indeed.
Yeah.
Do we have time for another duo?
Yeah, we've got right around a minute left in this segment.
I'm showing you MikeMe, M-I-K-M-E.
Yeah.
Which is a lavalier mic and a little kind of belt clip unit.
Yeah.
That allows you to connect this to, it's professional grade, but it's really a podcaster kind of thing.
Nice.
And if you've got the freedom of motion that this provides, it's golden. And look at this, the Lavalier Pro, a second separate lav mic you can buy separately for this or whatever else you happen to be doing. I'm trying to get other stuff for podcasters in here because having better voice quality makes a huge difference. I've asked Audio Technica for their new dynamic cardioid, and we'll talk about that if and when it comes.
Very nice. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation, Is Cybersecurity Really Important? Thursday, October the 28th. Starting time of meeting is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is pcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation by Personal Capital. Thursday, November the 4th at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, November the 5th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 11th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 12th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.